I'm Jacob Kimberg, and you're listening to Salty Cinema. My guest today is Eric Loxmo, executive producer of Last Days in the Desert. Eric is the owner and producer of marketing, distribution, and impact at Aspiration Entertainment and Media. He and his team have worked on some of my favorite films of the past 10 years, including Tree of Life, Calvary, and Selma. Eric served for 12 years in Washington, D.C. as a campaign strategist, cabinet-level speechwriter, Capitol Hill press secretary, and media advisor. In 2006, he left politics to be a project manager and then VP of Strategic Partnerships for Walden Media. Here is my conversation with Eric Loxmo. Read an article that you had written about whether Hollywood was worth saving, or I think that was the title, Is Hollywood Worth Saving? And you kind of laid out a few different points of what you think would help or is the future. So one thing that stood out to me was you talking about killing the middle movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that hit me because those are the movies that I really love, and that's kind of what I mourn the most about where the industry is heading.
Right,
is
right.
That's happening naturally, whether studios are taking your advice or not, like that seems to be going on. But I get your argument for why that is or why that could be a good thing. Do you want to elaborate on that?
Well, I saw it firsthand after my 12 years in politics. I went to Walden Media, and Walden was a perfect example of a middle-class filmmaker. Still is in some ways. But 2007, 6, 5, and earlier, so much revenue was generated by DVD sales. And by the time you hit 8, 9, 2010, that was dropping off as the market had matured. So you had a middle-sized budget, great actors, great storytelling, not making money. But what was making money is, at that time, Juno and Ones and smaller pictures that, again, had equally strong talent, maybe new discovered talent, but were much smaller and were more nimble in their distribution and marketing and in their productions. And then you had the big stuff. So it was like, right then you were seeing that everything was moving toward big or small, tentpole, or micro budget or small budget. And that was reflected in almost every industry and still is, that if you're in publishing, it's big authors or it's self-publishing. If you're in banking or you're in all these disruptive technologies that are happening around every industry, is the middleman and the middle size is going away. You're going big and small. Now, when I think about your films and your desire as a filmmaker, I actually think that you can do quite well with a small budget and smaller pictures, because smaller pictures allow for more independence. There's more risk to be taken. You have an audience that there are riches in the niches. You can find your audience and you can succeed on a smaller audience size, and distribution becomes more nimble, more risk taken, more potential rewards for you as a filmmaker. What's interesting right now is that these big films aren't working. So now that's probably, article's probably a few years old now.
Mm-hmm.
But the middle is going away and is gone. So how do you, as a storyteller, choose small or big? And there's certainly a different decision to be made if you're going to big. Big pictures, what that cycle would be.
I think the problem I see is that it still does cost a lot of money to make good art, especially films.
Mm-hmm.
Films are expensive. So what you have is the people who want to make really interesting things, but they don't want to work with $100,000. They should be able to work with $20 million.
Right,
you know,
right.
Like, to realize their vision of Paul Thomas Anderson or someone like that. So it's like, if that is what the industry becomes, it's either 100,000 or 100 million.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people that can't do their work anymore.
Yeah.
Or I guess it goes to TV because TV is sure. better now because of the budgets.
Yes. Yes. And that's where it's all gone. I think that's right. The best storytelling is on TV. You're seeing directors and talent and actors go there because they can be more creative and they can have be a part of a larger story series and experiment with new platforms like Netflix, fairly new platforms. But you know, it is true that when we think about a musician, you and I could spend the next hour, make a song, sing. I would be singing it very poorly. You could probably sing much better. We could make something and put on YouTube and have it out. Mm. Can't do that with film, right? We can't rush the process. We can't short circuit the process and the excellence needed to make good stories. So it's a completely different, it's hard to compare a book, which we could write a book in an hour or two and just throw a bunch of words out, try to sell it. Can't do that with film. So there is something about that the art of filmmaking requires a much higher level of investment, of talent, of time, of commitment to see something through. But when it comes down to it, the middle is going away because of the audience. It's not that there's less filmmakers or stories to be told. It's that the audience now is so segmented and fragmented that to be able to recoup that investment, you basically have to go against every trend in the audience now, which is tribal, fragmented, highly specialized. The other day I was walking by a newsstand, a magazine stand, and you go to Barnes & Noble, you see this. I was in L.A., a street side newsstand. You go to New York and see them on the streets. And you look at, there's a home section, home and design section that has 50 different types of home design. Gardening, small houses, southern houses, modern homes, traditional homes. And so you realize that even within these categories that we tend to broad brush, automotive, fashion, sports, there's so many different specialties, and that just makes it harder for marketing and aggregation of audiences to sell product.
Mm. Yeah, and that kind of leads to another thing that you talk about is, so audience are looking for trusted brands that help them make good decisions, something you said. So branding becomes the most important thing. How do you think a filmmaker or a production company finds that brand?
Well, filmmakers, I would say, are brands. Scorsese's a brand. Wes Anderson's a brand. There's even actors that are brands that they bring an audience with them. When you see a certain film by Scorsese, I know what I'm getting. I know I'm getting a certain kind of movie. So you're, in a sense, already telling the audience that this was made for you. Now, beyond that, you think about some of the companies in filmmaking who immediately draw an audience no matter what. So for us as a family, Pixar, I don't care if it's Cars 15, I'm probably going to go to it. So Pixar, Fox Searchlight, certainly Marvel, there's certain brands that just draw an audience based upon their body of work, and they're frankly, they're very focused on what they're delivering. They're not, the challenge with a big studio like Universal, Paramount, MGM in the days, Sony, is that they bring so many different styles of content, sizes, genres, talent, that there's not really a brand. It's more of a established company. People respect it and admire it, but you don't know what you're getting if you said, there's a Sony movie coming out. I wouldn't be able to tell you what that is. I could guess a bunch of different things.
Right.
Now, it takes a long time, a lot of investment to build a brand. But there could be big brands and small brands. We can create a brand that serves 10,000 people and serves them well, and actually you could have a viable business. Maybe not in film, but you could have a viable business in other categories with a brand that's respected and trusted, and there's loyal customers, and they look forward to the next thing you're bringing. And that really, to clear the clutter of the marketplace, you're going to have trusted curators and creators that are always speaking to their audience and then having a chance to just to narrow in on who their audience is. And that's just going to be increasingly more important as people look for all the choices they have, entertainment especially.
So do you tell filmmakers to lead with what they want to make and then figure out who that audience is, or say, I think I could serve people that like this type of thing, and then so I go make that type of thing?
Yeah, I think that all branding comes through happenstance and circumstance. So I don't think Under Armour set out to make a massive brand for all sports and athletes and kids. I don't think Fox Searchlight necessarily went out to make a brand for itself that would stand alone. But filmmakers, in this case, they're going to pick a project. They may have success, build a certain kind of audience. Then they pick the next one that I think is still organic to their view of the world, their style, what they want to say to the world through the art. And as time goes, the audience follows them. So it's a question of, do you pick the brand first, then you find the content, or do you create the content and then the brand comes? And I really think you've got to step out with what you care about, mm-hmm. and what you want to make, irregardless of whether the brand comes or not. But if you do it consistently, I think the key point is know your audience, be consistent in your content and what your creative is and the quality of it, and do it enough so it's not just one-offs or so sporadic, but you really are consistently building something. So the audience feels like this is something they look forward to time and time again. It satisfies them.
Let's talk about the films that you want to make. Your company is called Aspiration,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of talk about the difference between aspirational and inspirational. Mm-hmm. So what are you looking to do in this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a filmmaker in the truest sense. We have always been behind the scenes in the process of the goal being, how do you make the best ideas and best stories profitable and popular?
Mm-hmm.
So for us, that is a marketing, publicity, distribution, funding mechanism. There is enough great storytellers who have the right scripts and the right talent, but they don't have business sense. They don't have all the full view of what could be the potential of their project, or limitations or obstacles. They're artists, storytellers. You know, you're looking at the best possible script, production, editing, and you're done. And most times at that point, filmmakers come and say, okay, now what? And they haven't thought about audience, distribution, market conditions, how to monetize, how to build their own career, what's the next project. So just to get to your question, is that when we have a filmmaker comes into us, we typically say to them, you likely have three goals or three objectives. You cannot pick all three, but one is you want to recoup for investors. Two, you want to make your next film, or three, you want to have impact. Now, so many come in and say, I want all three of those to happen, and just not possible, because each of those requires a different strategy. For example, if you're looking to make your next film, I would do a lot of industry work and connections and distributor meetings and meeting with potential talent and agents and getting you press and social following so you can get momentum for your next project. If you're looking for impact, well, then we're probably going to build an initiative around your film that really does drive a double bottom line, has a measurable of social good that comes through it, building partnerships, different publicity plans. So that boils down to when a filmmaker comes to us, we're looking to see, are they the kind of storyteller that wants the audience to lean forward in their seats? There's many, many filmmakers, more inspirational filmmakers, that are satisfied with leaning back in your seat. You're causing enjoyment and delight in the audience. Nothing wrong with that. It's great. That is an important part of storytelling, but too often in the case of the church, capital C church, the body of Christians across the world, there's interest in, let's just create inspiring moments that in my words, are very fleeting. They come and go. You leave the theater and you're satisfied and you thought it was a great night, but that film is likely not going to stick with you long. You may forget about what's the last movie I saw. It was something good. Versus an aspirational view is we want the person to lean forward in their seats and almost, whether it's a small screen or big screen, that there's something about that story that compels them to do something else. So the screen is not the end of the destination. It's not the last part of the story. That's this jumping off point for something greater and much more impactful. That could be downloading a soundtrack, could be looking at the book, it could be meeting up with friends over a beer. But there's something that compels you beyond the screen. We call that screen forward. It is the idea of lean forward in your seat. The key part about aspirational content is that it asks the question, what's next? Or what else? Hmm. Inspirational basically says, this is momentarily a satisfying moment that causes a feeling of delight or of a memory, a feel-good moment versus a do-good moment. Hmm. So I don't know. The generation coming up to me is very aspirational. We know this by stats that they want something more. If they're going to give 2 hours of their time to something, we should provide them the satisfaction that there is something that contributes to their whole life, and they can use it as part of a launching off point for greater things.
So, along with the work that you do in marketing and distribution, you also have executive produced. Mm-hmm. What goes into you deciding what projects you are connected to in that way?
We started this whole thing by doing Last Days in the Desert, which is the Ewan McGregor film. Rodrigo Garcia is a well-known and established director that we love working with. He brought in Emmanuel Lubezki, who's a 3-time Academy Award-winning cinematographer. We had a small cast, great talent, great producing team. That was a story that, in our view, we wanted to do something that had a truly religious nature, but that was not a retelling of the biblical account, and that allowed for a conversation. Most of the films we work on and have put money behind would fall into the causation and conversation categories. Others are investing in conversion films, confirmation films, or commercial, highly commercial films like a Ben-Hur or a Exodus. You find more conversion and confirmation films in the faith-based market that are looking to say, I think it used to be, how can you use film to convert people? Mm-hmm. And now it's trended into, how can film be a place where like-minded people come together and express through their attendance that we are here, we're not leaving, we're big. And it's a dog in the corner mentality. Mm. There's a fear based of we have to make a statement. We call them internally bumper sticker movies. God's not dead. Heaven is for real. Is Genesis history. These are kind of movies that say in the title exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. It's not art. There's art that goes into it, but that's not art. It's really industrial filmmaking. And these are friends of mine, so I'm not being critical of the people who make it. I think it's what's happening in faith-based filmmaking, to get off topic. Mm-hmm. I'll get back to your question. What's happening in faith-based filmmaking is that when something like God's Not Dead works, it trains the audience that that is art and that's something that they should be supporting. Hmm. And it trains the industry that, oh, that's what Christians want. Now, we all know, though, that when you talk about faith or Christians, that is not a monolithic group. Right. It is not homogeneous. There's so many diversities and from regional differences, denominational differences, age differences, race differences. So for someone to say that faith-based movies represent the church is absolutely false.
Right.
Because you're basically saying it represents white, conservative, middle America, middle-class people. Mm. In fact, getting in hot water, I've tempted to tweet out that faith-based marketing is actually Trump voter marketing. I don't see differences between the two. The people going to certain faith-based movies are the certain same people that voted for Trump. Now, in that, there's a whole huge audience that we were trying to reach with Last Days in the Desert that is middle space. So we talked about middle-class films earlier, but middle space is where people are sitting. They're pushing back from faith-based, ideological, heavy-handed teach and preach. Mm. And they're also pushing back from the next big tentpole that is crass comedies, mass marketed, super hyped, lots of explosions, lots of big names. There's a middle that's there. The number one problem, though, we found is that they're not organized. They don't necessarily go out in groups. They're pretty laggard in their decision making, so they're going to wait until they get it to Netflix or Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if theatrical is not the outlet for that, are you making things for home entertainment? But there is a middle space, and it is aspirational. It is story driven. It is characters. It's wrestling with ambiguity. It's the kind of films like Calvary and Tree of Life and then Last Days, which I think are the trilogy for us, have been, those are key films for us. We started with Amazing Grace. We worked on Tree of Life, on Calvary, and many others along the way. But then Last Days in the Desert was this culmination of I want to do a film about Jesus. I don't want to do it as a retelling because I think it's actually harder and more dangerous to do that, try to do a retelling of how things actually were and who he is. So this film became our expression of an imagined chapter, the humanity of Jesus, which is overlooked. Is there a cold, shivering Jesus in the desert who's hungry and who has a rock in his shoe? Is that true? Well, I think it's true to the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that was... So Different Drummer was your company. Do you still... And Aspiration is separate or... has become that, or you're still...
Yeah, Aspiration's been around since 2014, January.
Okay.
We had four individuals who believed marketing was a part of it, but believed that they wanted to put more energy on distribution and some production. Increasingly, everything we do is based upon a marketing mindset and marketing model, an audience-first-centric, audience-centric approach. We are doing so many things that are building the platforms and apparatus and the audience capacities and acquisition of audiences and development that are, it's holistically looking at every piece of the process. Ideally, we're in a project early on from scripting and only when its life cycle has completed through the windows of its release. Hmm. With Different Drummer and marketing, we were candid projects the last 3 months before release, which over time, Different Drummer became Same Drummer. Same thing for the same people doing the same approaches that really increasingly were not working. By 2014-15, it'd be hard for me to say that the stuff that was being done for these studio projects was actually delivering measurable results. It became this pattern of the same old thing, same projects, same kind of, same leaders, same marketing tactics. And that's just not interesting to me, because the problem with marketing today, in film in particular, is especially in the faith-based space, impossible to prove that what you've done in your marketing is delivering tickets. You can show screenshots, you can show Facebook likes, you can show screenshots of blog posts, but no one knows whether to actually deliver tickets. And that drives me crazy. But if I'm a part of a project from day one, and it's, we're setting the budgets, we're setting the timelines, we're setting the release schedule, we're setting the creative, we're driving everything through, and we put money behind it, then not only do I feel the impact of having skin in the game, but also I can tell, did that work? We know that we have access to everything. And thankfully, increasingly over the time, we've learned what doesn't work and what does work. And a lot of the stuff that's being done for marketing doesn't work. It's just, it's a shell game and it's a bunch of window dressing. And it's sad that people are still propagating that type of marketing still.
So Last Days in the Desert was your first project of having that kind of control, being with it all the way through. Is that what you want to continue to do now?
Yeah, we're doing that more and more. We have several films that we'll pick up in the next this next season early on. Some are finished, some are in scripting. And it is sitting at the table with a filmmaker as a producer of marketing distribution that walks all the way through the project and helps navigate all that. Last Days is such an interesting example because on every level you'd say, well, that wasn't a commercial success. And that was never the driving force behind it. It was really to produce art that would last 50 to 100 years. And sometimes films, as we know, we've seen them, they're incredible film making, but they're not commercially viable and successful. So this film, Last Days, had lots of challenges. Again, middle space film, fairly slow and contemplative and meditative in its approach, deliberately so, trying to slow people down into a moment of the desert, alone, isolated, slow. Days pass slowly in the desert. But you do your best to market it, and it worked on many levels with the types of press we got and the type of reaction we got from critics and Sundance. But the audience is still not there yet, and that's not really a marketing problem. It's more of bringing an audience along with us so someday hopefully they go back and see it.
Calvary Tree of Life, Last Days. Of the past few years, those have been some of my favorite films and the best things that have been made with any kind of faith element, you know, especially at Calvary. I was blown away by Calvary. That, if I could point to something that would be like, I want to make something like that, it's Calvary. But when I talk to my wife, she would say she doesn't like any of those movies.
Yeah, that's
like, you know, am I like, is the audience too small for
it's pretty
that?
Small, pretty small. You know, the middle space runs from Blindside all the way down to Last Days in the Desert. And so it's a wide space and it leans different ways. But yeah, it's fascinating that Calvary, so few people have seen it, but it was the faith-based movie of the year in my mind of, was it 2012? 13?
14, I think.
No.
I think so.
Is it 14? Yes,
I remember tweeting in 2014 about it.
Oh my goodness. I think Tree of Life was earlier. That's
yeah,
right.
Tree of Life was.
Oh my goodness. I'm getting lost in my my world. But it's something that when people see it, they go, oh gosh, that rings so true. It's just an honest and deep and complex story. So it's interesting to see. 2011 was fascinating because I think it was 11, if I get my years mixed up, maybe 2009. But Fireproof came out and Slumdog Millionaire. Maybe that was 2009, probably. And it was, Slumdog Millionaire was the number one independent movie based upon reviews and awards. Number one most successful independent film was Fireproof in terms of box office. Mm-hmm. But you had friends who would walk in the theater and, I'm not going to go see that. I'm going to go see this. I'm not going to go see that. I'm going to see this. And it was an interesting dividing line between where I think the church began to split, which is some wanted that confirmation film. Others wanted just an incredible story of global impact and richness of characters. And that causes the start of, I think, a real divide, and which started many years earlier, but that really showed it to me. The independent world was changing. And, you know, this is, we're still seeing the effects of a market trying to figure out who this audience is and what do they want. Mm. I mean, Risen was the most successful, you know, studio pitcher in that year of Jesus films. Ben-Hur was an absolute total disaster. Mm. Why? I mean, is it because of fatigue in the audience? Is it because of marketing? Is it because it's the story? I mean, that's the question of the studio: is it worth it? Is it worth the investment to go after these audiences in this type of stories? And I think the future will be smaller independents, more experimental, more surgical, that can take risks. A studio shouldn't be taking risks with these kind of huge films that eventually you're going to make someone mad. Mm. Even if you try to make everybody agree on a certain biblical account, it's still going to make people mad.
Do you think the bigger studio involved faith-based films, when they do well, do they help allow for the smaller ones to continue to get made in the off chance that maybe one of those smaller ones does catch on? Because thinking mm-hmm. about where the Kendrick brothers started, you know, mm-hmm. if they were still making movies that were $50,000 or whatever, that had a return of a couple million, like their first couple, you know,
right.
I'm sure people will still want to try and throw money at filmmakers who might want to make those smaller films that have the potential of maybe, you know,
yeah.
blowing up. But that would probably get closed off if those bigger, courageous ones weren't finding a place in the market, right?
Yeah. Well, there's lots of things that Kendrick Brothers did absolutely brilliantly. I mean, they are building a brand. I think they have ongoing kind of market captains or action squad people who are always working on their projects even when they're not releasing, which is incredible. And that's genius to keep the brand going and introduce the next film. And they're always breaking the next story. But it's still independently created, mm-hmm. and then it's released to the studios, mm-hmm. Which I think the future needs to be independently made, independently released. Mm. I imagine those guys are looking at the balance sheets and saying, wait, why did the distributor make so much more than we did? And that's the case for all filmmakers. I mean, I don't necessarily believe this is true, but there is that idea that distributors and studios are designing their plans so that the producers never really make a dollar back. Their goal is to spend ahead of the producers, so it's never returning money. I think that's exaggeration. Mm-hmm. That's a conspiracy. I do think, though, that what we're trying to figure out here is you have the common sense idea of, well, this filmmaker has put in, let's say, $1 million through family and friends, investors. They put in all this creative development, blood, sweat, and tears, got their friends, you know, didn't eat for months, got to the place where they made a film. It's handed off to it in a transaction to a distributor who then says, okay, well, I'm going to then put some kind of marketing spend that's going to be the first in the waterfall to recoup. I'm going to have a distribution fee, and then you're going to make money. I think there's a better way to serve filmmakers. I've always thought that we are a filmmaker and storyteller friendly company, because I'm looking at, yes, there's investments we've made and there may be return needed, but is there more of a corridor deal or something where the money is going back to the filmmaker from dollar one, some percentage? And I think if we don't figure that out, we're going to always have one-off films, filmmakers having long gaps between their stories. Mm-hmm. We're going to have investors who are going to give up. And I want, like our investors, I want them to be in the game. Even if they have five projects and they make money on one or two, And maybe that recoups the entire investment of their five. You know, you have to give them a shot to keep in the game. Otherwise, we're just going to keep defaulting to a studio bank model, big money, spread out risk, bad deals for filmmakers. I first and foremost care about the audience and then the storyteller, because those are two elements of the process of filmmaking that get lost along the way, and it gets very transactional. We could do 10 transactional deals, and I guarantee we'll get screwed on 10 of them potentially, because you can screw anybody on a transaction. But if it's a relationship deal, if I know that filmmaker, worked with them in the past, we're together in the room, we've shared the blood, sweat, and tears, very hard for each other to get screwed, because there's a trust and loyalty and we're in this together. Same with distribution. A relational distribution deal to me is, we're in this together and I'm going to fight for every dollar so that you, as a filmmaker, get a chance to make your next film. And it only happens if I can make you money. It sounds very common sense, but I'm amazed how much the transactional side of the assembly line of filmmaking, very limited innovation and imagination about what to do different, a fear-based industry, it just punishes filmmakers.
Let's go back and track your kind of path to where you're at now. When did your interest in film begin? I know you had a career in politics, mm-hmm. speech writing. You want to kind of tell us about your path?
You know, all this is, to me, is not necessarily about the medium of film or TV. It's about the power of story and ideas. And I think my second half of my career has been about story. The first half is about ideas, although I think they all go together. But I went to DC because I believed in the power of ideas. And I believe that great writing and oratory and rhetoric and communications could shape hearts and minds in a way that was missing or that needed improvement. How do you inspire an audience? How do you move an audience to act upon something? How do you not just provide information, but educate people about what's important and what's worth living for? And politics is an amazing platform for that. Along the way, though, I learned that there's limitations in a bureaucracy of two parties who are very similar. Structurally, it's hard to get messages out, to be creative. And we would see, and we were part of conversations in D.C. about artists and poets and actors and writers, people in business who are having great impact and were shaping hearts and minds more than we could on the House floor or in the White House. And that was interesting to me because I was a creative person growing up and loved design and loved writing and could see that, well, upstream there's a lot more interesting things happening when it comes to what people believe and how they behave. And people aren't remembering C-SPAN speeches and bills passing the floor. It was natural. It didn't happen like I'm going to set my course to now bring propaganda to the arts. But it was, I'm artistically inclined. I love great stories, great ideas. And I had the chance to work on Amazing Grace, which combined all those things. It combined my political love of how to like-minded people with great intentions get things done that are impossible. With amazing storytelling from Michael Apted and that is Benedict Cumberbatch was in that movie. It's crazy to look back. It's his early career. And it just combined a number of things together that really lit to me is how can film have social impact? I was not content with working on films that, again, like we talked about, that just left the audience sitting there and leaving. Mm. One filmmaker said, the greatest nightmare for any producer or filmmaker is that the audience would use your film for 2 hours of air conditioning on a hot summer day. And that's true. Like, you want more. I mean, every filmmaker now is thinking legacy, impact, how does it keep evergreen stories keep going? But yeah, Amazing Grace was eye-opening in that it's the pitch is impossible, right? It's here's a story about a guy who is wearing a wig, and he lives in the 1800s, early 1800s, and he's passing a bill to end something that hasn't been around for, in their minds, it hasn't been around for a couple hundred years, and no one knows about him. So it's an impossible pitch, but of course in politics we knew about Wilberforce, and there's so much more things about him that were fascinating and relevant to the fact that there's more slaves today than ever. There's a lot of things that we haven't finished the work of Wilberforce. But in the Hollywood studio world, they were defaulting to the tagline of one man changes the world, one man changes the world forever. Well, that's not true. It was one man and some friends who gave their lives towards something greater than themselves, and only at his weakest moment, right before his death, did he see, after repeated failures, some success. Well, that's more interesting to me when I think about failure, which I don't trust people who haven't failed. If anybody comes in here as an intern or as an employee that says they've got to figure it out, they're out the door. I hope they've failed a lot, because I failed. And every time I fail, I'm only hoping that I failed forward. But failure, it means that you're trying. And I know folks who think that they have not failed one bit, and that's sad, because they're not taking risks. So Wilberforce took huge risks, to his life, to his popularity, his health, and I mean, amazing that he got to see the end of the slave trade in his lifetime. So that was my journey into seeing, wow, a story can change the world. It can. But more importantly, it changed me, and it changes people in real time. I could see leaders weeping. I could see people, and I saw that with Tree of Life. I mean, we go in and we have some people leave halfway through frustrated with dinosaurs and volcanoes. Other people in the seats were weeping. Okay, that's only art can do that. I don't know what else can.
So when you were in Washington, was it similar, dissimilar to what we would see on West Wing or House of Cards? How would you describe
Someone said the other day, they said, what's the one show that's been most similar to DC? And they were a political person. Someone asked them, what's the one show of all the shows, Mr. Sterling and West Wing and House of Cards and all this? And he said, you know what? The one show that's most similar is Veep. And I started laughing, because I was thinking, yep, there's the incompetence, there's the arrogance, there's the backbiting, the cynical nature of it all. And I'm like, well, that sounds like Hollywood too. There's
so
a lot of
less the villainous, power hungry, at least on the surface, I guess. Maybe,
yeah, it's not that sophisticated. I think it's you have 25-year-olds running the country, you have a level of the most erratic work ethic and hours ever. So you're working crazy hours, and then all of August, typically, you don't work at all. You just sit around, listening to music, watching movies. You could develop horrible habits of work, because it's an intense time, then it's no time. They're all off at their homes. But I'll tell you that it's astonishing to me that I find it fascinating that people are seeing this through a lens of the news and C-SPAN and headlines. When you get down in there, most of these people are friendly to each other, and there's a collegiality that happens, but they have to play it up, the divisiveness, for the cameras and for the headlines. I think right now, though, I've not been in politics for a while, but right now it is probably how it is. Like, it's probably really intense and divided, but in my time it wasn't. But there's such a young people go there for passionate reasons. They sacrifice potential revenue, salaries, to work in the positions of influence. No one asks you how much you make or what you do. They ask who you work for in DC. So if someone, they'll ask you, you know, on the street, who you work for. And typically it's a person. Now, coming out of that, I feel like everybody should spend some time working in DC, because you learn how to deal with very difficult people in complex situations working with coalitions of different partners to get things done, and you learn how to spend your entire year on a bill or some centerpiece legislation, and it could fail at the last minute. So there's a lot of great lessons to be learned, but there are similarities between LA. I mean, it's there's deadlines and there's campaign mentalities. When a movie releases, it's voting day. Mm-hmm. You win or you lose. Mm. And so much of what you've done along the way in film marketing, you don't know whether it's working or not, which is why it drives you crazy. At least in politics, you can know in a campaign if it's working. You can feel better, feel more. One thing I do love about film marketing is that on the lower you go to the grassroots, you can feel if a film's working or not. Especially independents, you can feel momentum. I do miss a bit of the political life, but I don't miss most of it.
So, have you wanted to make political films, or have you kind of wanted to separate that and be more purely artistic in the film projects that you're associated with?
My view is that this idea of common grace is central to my view of politics and of art, in that wherever there's goodness, truth, and beauty, I'm going to be behind it. I'm going to publicize it. I'm going to promote it. I don't care who makes it. If it's truly good, truly beautiful, truly true, then I'm not caring about party. I'm not caring about whether it's a Christian filmmaker or not. The problem is that we've had in this film space and storytelling spaces, we have well-told lies, you know, great talent, lots of money telling lies. We have poorly told truths. We have Christians who are trying to say the truth, but they're doing it in a way that's kind of ham-fisted and not elegant. Mm-hmm. So why can't we be the people who have well-told truths?
Yeah.
Like that's my mantra is, there's no reason why the Christian in politics or in art can't go further, go deeper, go higher than the rest. We know and we claim to know a story that has an end, and has an end and has no end. And we know that there's victory on the other side of the cross and the empty tomb. We know that our story includes the most horrific act in history, which was the crucifixion of an innocent savior. Who was a political figure and a religious figure, but he came for different reasons. We know that we also contain our story, the most glorious act in history, the overcoming of death and the stain of our sin forever. Now, those bookends allow the Christian filmmaker, storyteller, to have a lot of room to run. And C.S. Lewis wrote a book in the voice of a demon. And it's a beloved book. So we really have some room there. We have a savior who went into hell, according to the Apostles' Creed, after his crucifixion. So we have these heights and depths that I think, unfortunately, this is where we're seeing the audience and the filmmaker change and storyteller change, is that there's a pushing back on, it's got to be a Sunday story. It's got to be the victory stories. And there's some that want to go just to the Friday stories, the darkest hour. I feel like we're Saturday people. Like we're in between the tension.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm hopeful that the future of storytelling in the church happens, is that it's coming off of Friday, it's seen Sunday coming, but it's still in the middle. We're still in the now but not yet.
I read something recently that Judd Apatow was talking about why he was referring to conservatives, not to Christians, but why conservatives have a hard time making good art or good things. And he was saying it's because they don't want to show the grime and the dirt of themselves. We're not like
so true
confessional enough. That shouldn't be true, because as Christians, we're all about confessing we should be about confessing our sins and saying, you know, help me, Lord, I'm a sinner, you know, but you know, for some reason, it's like the stories that we tell, we don't show that or don't know how to show that, you know.
That's a great point. I think it's changing, but there's a lack of honesty in our storytelling. This is why Flannery O'Connor is resurging, because she left it open-ended and she left it with difficult. I was reading Revelation, the short story, and it's like, wow, that's intense and it's difficult. But the Christian has been prone to be prescriptive in their storytelling. It's a moment, we have a captive audience, so we can't leave anything hanging. We've got to close the argument. We've got to wrap it up nicely. Versus descriptive storytelling, which leads you into an understanding of a character and its darkness and our own darkness and our own grittiness and mess, and may not get them out of that mess, but at least begins to describe the condition of our humanity in a way that people can identify with and then begin to wrestle with on their own. This is partly a pre-Christian versus a post-Christian culture view. Our view here is that we're in a pre-Christian moment. So we're not, if you see a post-Christian mindset, it's we're fighting, we lost, we're on our heels, our posture is to resist. That's fine, and some people are into that. Pre-Christian is asking questions, telling stories, being curious, being thoughtful, being innovative, thinking about where are people at, where's pluralistic society, how do we introduce new truths in old truths in new ways. It's a more optimistic view that we're back to square one. If you're back to square one, then you rethink everything. Not your ancient faith traditions, but you rethink, okay, people are not sharing that with me. So how do I ask them a question that could lead them to some deeper thought?
Do you think the argument on the other side of that is that people, we have answers to the big questions that we want to share. We have a hope that we want to give mm-hmm. to people. So there's a sense that we don't want to leave people in their lostness, just mm-hmm. as we have lots of movies that show people how lost they are.
Yeah, yeah.
But we don't have lots of movies that show people that Jesus loves them and yeah, Jesus is the yeah. answer. So there's kind of like, well, shouldn't we be the ones making those stories?
Yeah. The answer is yes. Although this is maybe a theological discussion over many beers, it is not my job to save people. Right. Best I can do is be available, mm-hmm. tell the truth, point, be a signpost.
Yeah.
So if my art gets people a little bit uncomfortable and they have to wrestle through some big questions, I believe that God's big enough that he's going to work through that. Otherwise, you're designing your story with the end in mind. I'm not sure that I was thinking about, is it Flannery or is it maybe Madeleine Langle who said, I think it's one of those two, both great examples, but they would write a story and there'd be a surprise character that walk in the door. Okay, so that's interesting. Mm-hmm. They're writing a story that they have in mind, but they're unpacking as they go and they're writing it in real time. So all of a sudden this character walks in and they're almost like surprised by it. Oh, who's this? And write into the story. I think if you sit down and go, okay, the end goal is, and this is kind of a Kendrick Brothers model, the end goal is we want to have 40,000 churches reading this book on marriage by the end of 2010. All right, well, then you've basically created your script around a whole programmatic view. Okay, not that there's anything wrong with that. It's but if the view is, can I move people or delight people in a way that I give them a glimpse of a world that could be otherwise, mm-hmm. to use Oz Guinness's words, that might be enough. And that's, and hopefully over time, enough of that kind of work can create the critical mass and really show people that, boy, those, I would love it if those, they could someday, you could say, those Christians, boy, they're great storytellers. They're honest. They know what is happening in the heart of man and woman, and their stuff's going to stick around for a lot of years. Right now, we're creating stuff that lasts for a season or two, and that's, to me, is a bad stewardship. It's not even a model that I can believe in. Versus, what are the things that in 500 years are going to go, that was great art? That's what the church should be. Not next year, not next election, 500 years.